All right, everybody, good morning. Anybody there? Somebody there? Say hi. Good. Well, this is our last day. Let's see. I think I probably should take care of some business. We have to talk about the final project. As I said in the syllabus, I'd be happy to have you write, I would say, an opinion in the Donius case that is pending in the Southern District, but I don't think there's any materials to rely upon to write an opinion. I don't think that there are any briefs in. I was checking that the other day. It seems to be sort of delayed right now. So we'll have to strike that. And if you really want to talk about the Donius or Rincon Mushroom case, maybe we can work something out. That's fine too. But what I would like to have you do is to find a case that has been fully briefed, at least in some respects, so that without an opinion, so that you can take the act of judicial thinking and write something on that. Or write an amicus brief. So the FMC Corp case is at the cert stage level of the Supreme Court. We can just assume that it's been granted or denied. It doesn't matter, but you can serve as an amicus. If you're going to do that, I would like for you to choose an entity. You could choose the Rincon Band, argue why the FMC case is important to you and why you want it why you want an outcome in your favor. You could choose National Congress of American Indians. You could choose other polluters and say why the case is important and why it should go in the favor of non-members. It would be useful, although I'm not going to require it. But if you want to reach out to me and talk to me about potential, basically clients that you would represent in an amicus brief in that kind of case. There is a student or two has reached out to me and suggested a case as well that they know that's out there, and that's perfectly fine as well. Currently pending in the Supreme Court anyway, which is a small universe of cases, are several cases like, there's a tax case out of Oklahoma that might be interesting. If you want to write about, if we're going to talk about criminal jurisdiction, you can certainly write about McGirt or Murphy. I understand that some of you are already writing about that case in other classes. So if you're doing that in another class, I would definitely prefer you not to do that in this case, in this class. If you go to the Native American Rights Fund page for cases that have already been denied cert, those are also fair game for possible final projects. There is the Knighton versus Cedarville Rancheria case, which is a tribal court jurisdiction case. And Knighton is the non-member. He doesn't want to be under Cedarville jurisdiction. And all those briefs are on the Native American Rights Fund. They're also on Turtle Talk. So you can just reach out to either of those places and find those cases. You can write about that one as well. That'd be perfectly fine. There's the Spur versus Pope case. You read Spur v. Spur. Spur versus Pope is the federal court action. I mentioned that one was denied. The Supreme Court denied cert in that case. You can certainly write about that one if you'd like. It's sort of it's a civil PPO jurisdiction issue that has elements of criminal action, so that might be interesting. There's a few ICWA cases in there too. We didn't talk all that much about ICWA, but if you want to write about ICWA, there's the Watso case. There's the Ogallala Sioux Tribe versus Fleming case. Those are all fair game. I would be fine with that. There's a few others too, but those are primarily the ones that I think probably fit the bill for our purposes. Any questions or any other ideas, things you want to write about? You can ask now or you can email later. And like I said, I think we settled on a July 19th due date. So just send me by email to my MSU account your final project and any questions you have before then. But to my MSU email, I check that. That's my regular email, so that would be the best one. Questions? Oh, maybe there's one in the chat. So the website, here, let me, I'll send you the website I'm talking about, which I should do anyway. So the Native American Rights Fund keeps a site for the Tribal Supreme Court project. And I'm looking for it on my iPad right now. It's really, where would I have put that? Sorry, I can't find it. I'll just Google it. Boop, there it is. Copy. So I just put the link in the chat to the term this year's term. So it has a list of a lot of the cases that are pending. FMC is in there. The Oklahoma tax case, which is Rogers County, is in there. All the materials on McGirt and Murphy, but we're not going to do that, so forget that. You see the Knighton case under the list of cert denied and some other cases for V. Pope. You can also look at older cases if you want. On the right, you'll see a list of a bunch of Octobers from the last several years. And the Supreme Court refers to its years as the October term. So last year, there were some tribal cases. I wouldn't focus on cases that were decided, but let's see. If you want to talk about, we didn't talk about it much in this class, but it would fit the bill a little bit. Cases involving federal statutes of general applicability could fit. So last year in the 2018 term, there was a Porch Creek case that had to do with tribal immunity and a lawsuit against the tribe, which was kind of interesting. Teck Metals is a case where the Colville tribes and tribal citizens were able to apply federal environmental laws against an international company right out of Canada for polluting its lake. That's kind of interesting. Wilson versus Horton Towing, in the October term 2018, is a tribal jurisdiction case as well. Harvey. Harvey is a good one. Harvey versus Ute, also in the 2018 term. Harvey were police officers who went on the reservation and shot somebody. So if you're into police brutality, not in a way like, I mean, you like police brutality, but if you are interested in that, it's sort of an interesting topic, obviously. There's state police officers who shot somebody on the res and then were sued in tribal court. And I think that case is still pending. That's an interesting one. That one's from last year, so. Anyway, if you have another case that you're interested in writing about, please do. And again, the idea, if you pick a Supreme Court case that's pending, where the cert has been denied, really what I'd like you to do is choose an amicus. Choose a client. If you want to choose the parties to the case, that's fine, but I think it's more fun for you if you choose an amicus. That way you can actually pick a client that's a little bit wacko if you want to, and play with it a little bit and try to make it have fun with it. So. McNeil, that's another one, versus Navajo Nation. I think that's a tribal court jurisdiction case as well in the October 2018 term. Anyway, questions? Oh, we got another chat question. So, I don't know, 10, 15 pages, double-spaced. It's one credit class, so. And that is a taco cat, yes. It's a palindrome. My son drew that. I made him do it. He was not interested. He's moved on from Taco Cats. All right. Any other questions? Well, I don't really have much of an agenda today, so there's a couple of things we can do. One thing is, and I hope you take the bait on this, and I don't mean it's not a trap, but I would love to just have you ask me questions. And anything about the scope of the class, from within the scope of the class, without the scope of the class, anything related to Indian law. I gave you some short articles to read. You know, I can talk a little bit about them, and that would be my second favorite thing to do. My first favorite is to answer questions that you have. So, please, Alex, you're raising your hand. I see your face. Go ahead. That's a great question. I didn't know about that. So the factual predicate is that you can't get into the eastern side of the park unless you go through the Blackfeet Reservation. Is that what you're saying? Okay. That fascinating. Okay. Good to know. All right. That's going to be interesting. So you know the Department of the Interior is, you know, under the administration is trying to open up national parks left and right to try to say, get away from those sick people in the city who are protesting, go camping. So you've got the federal government with an interest in opening up the park. And what we know, I have no idea, I'm just speculating. This is my initial response, and I think there's a lot of interesting factors that might come up, interesting issues. The first one is, I think the Interior Department and the federal government in general might put some pressure on Blackfeet. So if you've been following what's been going on in South Dakota, thanks for sending me that link. I think that's really interesting. If you've been following what's going on in South Dakota, there's a couple of tribes that did some roadblocks. And, you know, for a while, the governor of South Dakota was, you know, running around hair on fire and was threatening a lawsuit, which wouldn't do anything because, you know, when a state sues a tribe, their tribe is immune from suit. So the governor never brought the suit. Instead, tried to go over the tribe's head and get the Department of the Interior to lean on the tribe. And after a very long period of time, the federal government did threaten to pull law enforcement funding and some other money from the tribe. So just this week, we posted on Turtle Talk, Matt Campbell from Native American Rights Fund, representing Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, sued Donald Trump, actually. So I think that would be one avenue, the Department of the Interior, somebody in the federal government issuing a threat like that, maybe even, I don't know, refusing to release CARES Act funds or 638 money or whatever to force the tribe to capitulate. So that's one avenue. The paper that I put up on the syllabus that I called Indian Lives Matter, long before I called it that, before there was, you know, the Black Lives Matter thing came into play. And that paper should be published in the next week or so online with Stanford Law Review. That is the factual predicate for that, the supposition for that is non-members who are challenging the tribe's roadblock. The Navajo, my interest in that case came from very early on when Navajo started its weekend curfews. And when they announced the very first one, they got two letters from county attorneys and sheriffs from two counties in New Mexico, very, very red counties, McKinley County and I think Cibola County, who basically said, you can have a curfew all you want, but the curfew does not apply to non-Indians. And so I have friends who work. I'm a good friend with the Attorney General for Navajo. We work with her on the Tribal and House Council Association, and she was pretty annoyed by that. And I said, so it just got me into thinking about writing a Montana 2 article relating to what would happen if the tribe did put up quarantine orders, whatever that might be. It could be a curfew, roadblocks, whatever. And whether or not it could apply to non-members within the reservation, but on state highways, for example, which are, as you know from Strait, considered non-Indian lands. And, you know, I don't know how that would be litigated. I'm not a public health specialist, and there isn't really are hardly any cases on in the last 80 years other, until the last couple of weeks or a month or so with some states on, you know, on pandemic law, on epidemiology. So I have no idea how that would apply. But it seems to me that if a tribe like Navajo is already suffering amazing, horrible consequences from a pandemic and is trying to take action that non-members are flouting, seems to me that that fits the Montana 2 test. But again, I don't go into much detail because I don't know what that would look like, what that litigation would look like. And as far as I know, there hasn't been any litigation like that. But it would be really easy. Navajo has given civil citations to Indians and non-Indians in violation of the curfew. The governors of both Arizona, I don't know about Arizona, but the governor of New Mexico has supported and actually sent, at least in Gallup, New Mexico has sent troopers to help out with the Navajos with their curfew. So I think that diffused some of that issue to make in relation to the potential conflict between a direct conflict between the tribe's jurisdiction and non-members, because New Mexico has sort of intervened to help out. So I can imagine easily somebody leaving the Glacier Park, entering Blackfeet territory and getting a citation from Blackfeet, a civil citation, and then you have a direct conflict between the tribe and you know its jurisdiction over non-members. I don't know much of the demographic or the land ownership pattern at Blackfeet, if it's mostly, if it's checkerboarded or it's mostly tribal. And that would certainly matter if we're talking about state highways or we're talking about a lot of land that is owned by non-members. I don't know. I imagine that if this occurs on a state highway, there, you know, you'd have a straight analysis. They would be, it would be considered non-Indian land for purposes of tribal jurisdiction. And then the tribe would have to put on a Montana 2 defense effectively to say that, you know, they're trying to protect themselves from the pandemic. So yeah, I think that's fascinating. I've been trying to, I wrote a short essay to try to get the an online news magazine to publish it about a month ago, and they were really interested, and then I just got lost track of it, and then I came back to it last week, and because of the new lawsuit brought in by the tribes in South Dakota against Trump, and now this Blackfeet thing adds fuel to the fire, absolutely. So I appreciate you sending that along. Very helpful. Yeah, I think absolutely. If the land on either side of the highway is owned by tribe by the tribe or isn't held in trust or something, or even by individual Indian allotments, I think that you could say that. I don't know. Again, as a practical matter, I don't think that's possible because Blackfeet's just big enough so that people are going to stop. And, you know, I think I have not read the complaint carefully in Cheyenne River Sioux, but I'm pretty sure that the tribe is alleging that in some places, when tribal police have interaction with non-members with COVID, that the police have gotten COVID, at least on one reservation. I need to go back and read that complaint again. So just being on, you know, the tribe is cross-deputized on the state highway, I'm sure. Then, and if that's the case, then there will be interactions between, you know, regardless of whether they leave the road or not. So, Yeah, I mean, the tribe could frame their, try to create a canal, I guess, a tunnel through the reservation. But as a practical matter, I just don't see that working out. That's a good question, though. I'm sure they're thinking about it that way. Yeah, I mean, that definitely helps the optics, and it's likely that if Governor Bullock, if the state highway is patrolled, is there a state police force? I mean, we have the Michigan State Police, which they think of themselves as like the FBI of the state of Michigan, or the Texas Rangers, or some shit like that. If the police that patrol the highway that goes through the reservation is sort of directly accountable to the governor, then that makes it easier, makes the optics a lot better. And it probably it doesn't help with the federal government. I mean, Trump doesn't give a shit about the governor of Montana, or the Trump administration. But it definitely helps the optics. I think it makes the Montana 2 case a little bit easier, but it's not dispositive. Just don't know. One of the reasons that I sort of let the paper, the paper that that I wrote on South Dakota and Navajo, sort of lapse, and I even thought maybe it had been sort of the timeliness of it had died, is because it seemed like here in Michigan in particular, we're winning on the pandemic, and we've got one of the three or four states that had it the worst. We're also one of the three or four states that are turning it around. But it's apparent that that's not the case in pretty much all the rest of the United States. And it sounds like it's even sadly turning around here in Michigan. There's a student bar here in town that last week led to 43 new COVID infections of, basically 18 to 25-year-olds, most of whom weren't even supposed to be in the fucking bar. So, I don't know. I think it's, maybe it's back to being timely again, which is sad and unfortunate. Yeah, they're redoing the curfews again on the weekends, right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, in Michigan, the governor's strongly anti pandemic, is very strong on has tough quarantine rules, and so we've had many rebellions around the state from red counties where the prosecutor and the sheriff's office just refuses to enforce the quarantine order. And we've got some judges that have struck down aspects of the quarantine orders, although those are sort of getting reversed on appeal one by one. So it's and the tribes, ironically, they want to open up, especially the ones in the north that are sort of in rural areas. The Upper Peninsula tribes were basically saying in Wisconsin, their competitors are opening up and making lots of money, and they're getting screwed. And so they were going to open up, and not the state can oppose that, but they can't do anything about it. So it was really ugly there for a while, but. Now most everything in the northern part of the state of Michigan is open. Just basically like it's, I was going to say Texas, but it sounds like Texas today closed down all its bars, which kind of blew my mind. I can't believe they did that. So I'm glad. I mean, it's not like I hate people in Texas. I want them to live, but it just blew my mind that a state that only has like five laws actually did something like that. So it's trippy. Any other questions? Okay. Wow. So the rodeo is not operated by the tribe, it's operated by. Oh, the rodeo is. Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, if it's on non-Indian land within the reservation, good luck. The tribe can try to prohibit it, and enforce, try to enforce the quarantine, enact a quarantine order and then try to enforce it. But it'd be, I mean, it, all th these cases should be relatively easy, but because of the potential impacts are so catastrophic, right? But I don't know. I really have no idea. It's the same thing. I think that would be a really hard case to win. And the reason is that it's so serious, ironically. When you have so many non-members who want to do something so badly, it's as if, the worse, ironically, the worse the impact, the more likely it is that a federal court would say, well, there's nothing we can do about it. That would be my guess, sadly enough. These cases are not decided on like a rule of law, they're decided on gut checks, right? So like the optics matter so much. So when Shoshone Bannock says there's 22 million tons of radioactive waste on our reservation, they get a really nice sympathetic panel in the Ninth Circuit and Federal District Court. When Rincon goes and says there's this guy who has a trailer that he won't let us look inside, and we think that he's doing terrible stuff in it, the optics don't look nearly as bad as that. So that tends to be how the analysis is. So if a tribe is really suffering from, like Navajo, I think would probably win a case. If tribe is really suffering from the pandemic and is just trying to, limit its losses, I think it would get a better hearing. A more sympathetic federal court to hear it. But if it's a big party that non-Indians want to do, just happens to be within the reservation boundaries, regardless of the damage to the tribe, I don't know. I mean, it just, the weird thing is, people love rodeos and shit like that. So nobody loves toxic waste, but they love rodeos. So I don't know. I have no idea. But it's teed right up. So is the tribe, I like what you were saying though. The tribe is trying to tell its own citizens to stay away for their own personal protection. And the tribe can do that too, but again, the enforceability of something like that is just, for any government, is really difficult. When is that rodeo supposed to happen, Montana? Oh, that's fast. That's coming up real quick. I assume Flathead's not doing their big powwow this next week, are they? Or the week after? Do you know? Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was asking, Arlie, sorry. Yeah. Well, what are the questions? What else can we talk about? You could still ask it. Go ahead. No, that's a great question. So, tribes often enter in agreements with local jurisdictions and have the non-tribal jurisdictions come onto their property to enforce state or local law. They can do that against non-Indians. And the majority of the most the vast majority of casino patrons around the country are not Indians, just because that's the demographics of the US. So, about 10 years ago-ish, there was a tribe in the Upper Peninsula here in Michigan that just really loves to talk about how sovereign they are. And they are just the sovereignty warriors of the state of Michigan, just super tough. But they cut a deal to let local police do drug stings and undercover drug busts at the casino property. They made a judgment that there were all this drug dealing going on, non-member to non-Indian to non-Indian, and they couldn't do anything about it. So they let these, they basically turned over control of their casino at times to outside non-Indian jurisdiction. And the people who were getting popped by the county were filing these appeals in the Michigan Court of Appeals, saying there's no jurisdiction of the state on Indian lands, citing Worcester versus Georgia, and saying state law has no force in Indian country. And that was a kind of an interesting question. There's a really weird gray area in Indian law about criminal jurisdiction on Indian lands that has to do with non-Indians. And so we didn't talk about it, but there's a series of cases, goes way back into the 19th century, where non-Indian on non-Indian crime and or victimless crimes committed by non-Indians. There's no such thing, by the way, as a victimless crime, but those two categories of crimes can be prosecuted by states. They obviously can't be prosecuted by the tribes because of Oliphant. But even the feds, I think, if you can find a statute that's applicable, could prosecute those cases. But for the most part, the states prosecute them. And there's no theory that makes any sense as to why that's the case. The very first case in this vein, the Supreme Court said that under the equal footing doctrine, which we haven't talked about, but when a state enters the union, it comes in on the equal footing of all other states. The state is just like any other state, that is a new state. I think it was Colorado. And they, the court said because they come in on equal footing, they have jurisdiction over Indian country, and that's just flat wrong, right? I mean, it's still that kind of doctrine still comes up. There's a Ward v. Racehorse case that the conservatives, Justice Kavanaugh, really loves, that made a big, they made a big deal about it in the Herrera case last year, but that case is dead. I mean, you. Tribal treaty, those are the treaty rights case, but tribal treaty rights survive the entrance of a state into the union by definition. So, but the theory of Ward v. Racehorse is that states ex can exercise jurisdiction over Indian country as a general matter, except the states that were forced to disclaim jurisdiction over Indian country. And many states in the West had to do that as a condition of entrance. So the first case in this vein was a case where it's a place where a state didn't disclaim jurisdiction. And the second case, a few decades later, the state did disclaim jurisdiction. The Supreme Court said, it doesn't matter. They can still have jurisdiction. Why? We don't care. It's, you know, there's no analysis. In any event, what it means is the states do have jurisdiction over crimes committed by non-Indians against non-Indians. And the states have jurisdiction over victimless crimes committed by non-Indians. So the purse snatching thing, as a victim, it's another non-Indian, then, and the perpetrator is non-Indian, the state can prosecute those cases. It's complicated because most states are not generally allowed to just wander around, send their police into Indian casinos and patrol without the permission of the tribe. So that doesn't happen as much as it could, but the tribe could give that permission. Absolutely. It's a weird world. You know, it just really is. So, and I assume your uncle isn't happy with you because he's a cop and you probably posted something in favor of like defunding the police or something. Yeah, we're all there. There you go. All right, Montana, I know you're up there. You had a question too, like another one, or is anybody else? Someone who hasn't spoken up yet, perhaps? Oh, I had a little bit of a staticky thing going on there. I don't know what happened. Go ahead, try again. Okay. No, I don't think so. You just have to, you're never going to get a court that is, I don't think there's a judge that's truly a textualist, right? I don't think there ever was such a thing. You may have, I mean, Justice Gorsuch is probably the closest thing. Justice Scalia before him was the closest thing. There were areas of law that they didn't care that much about. So they would issue rulings that Justice Scalia was always like a confrontation clause guy. So if somebody brought a confrontation clause thing to the court, he was always letting people out of jail because they under the confrontation clause because of some weird interpretation of the confrontation clause text that he was supportive of. But he was not a textualist. I mean, all you got to do is read Heller versus D.C., the Second Amendment case. And you can see that he's a complete liar when it comes to textualism. Whether you agree with gun rights or not, you know, the Second Amendment does not grant everybody the right to have a fucking machine gun anytime they want one. That's just a plain old fact. There's no government in the world that would allow that to happen. And certainly not the people who were in charge of writing the Second Amendment ever would have thought that it would be a good idea to let Indians and black people run around with guns, or women for that matter. So that the whole DC versus Heller thing is a complete lie, and everybody knows it. So, but back to your question, do we need a whole new court? No, you need to learn a couple of things about the Supreme Court that are more important about the text. One is, structurally, they're designed to make sure that tribes lose. And that is a function of the Constitution itself. You know, the Constitution is designed to... on its text, it's designed to protect states' rights and federal government rights, to protect and regulate them and describe them. So if a tribe has political interests that are in contradiction to a state's political interest, then the Supreme Court is going to look to the U.S. Constitution to try to figure out whose interests are more important. The states will always win that every single time. That is why preemption cases don't go well for tribes when it's the tribe's interest against the state's interest. The states, by definition, will win that every single time. Now, if the federal government sides with the tribe and asserts its own interest, then the tribal interest might prevail, but only because the federal government has more interest. On a more sort of wishy-washy type way, structurally, the Supreme Court, because of who the people are and who they work for and who works for them, and where they are as they come from, they're always going to be pretty skeptical of tribal interests. So the way to get on the Supreme Court tends to be you need to work for the federal government for a while in some way. Usually the high-level executive branch, the Solicitor General's office, the office of a legal counsel that, you know, directly works, represents the president. You need to work for the Senate Judiciary Committee as a lawyer, something like that. You need to be a high-level Fed. And, you know, what you learn when you become a high-level Fed is you learn deference to the powers of the executive branch and to Congress. So those, you know, all of the judges on the Supreme Court, even the liberal ones, come from that background. Even Sotomayor was a federal prosecutor. So they're trained to be skeptical of anybody who is not those things. And sometimes they're liberal. So they're like, I'm sympathetic to people who are poor or disadvantaged or entities that are having bad things happen to them. But they fundamentally will not accept the undermining of executive branch or congressional powers. They just won't do it. And tribes tend to be, the things that tribes are trying to assert tend to be antithetical to federal government interests. And almost always, not almost always, but often, probably more so, are antithetical to state interests. So it used to be that Supreme Court judges 50 years ago and earlier than that often came from states. That is almost never the case anymore. Almost, I think, as far as I can tell, every judge on the Supreme Court right now, their initial background was federal to begin with. And I think that is a huge thumb on the scale against tribal interests by definition. RBG may be the only non-federal person, as far as I can tell. And she's probably the oldest person on the court. And she came from, you know, as a law professor, she came from a civil rights background, you know, working with the ACLU, doing a lot of those cases in the 70s, and they made movies about her because of that. And that's all great. But she did spend a good decade as a DC Circuit judge, and she was effectively in the DC Circuit. You're constantly being explained by the federal government how to defer to the federal government. And, you know, there's very little way to get around that. So she's still indoctrinated into sort of that federal system. So the people who are on the court tend to be pro-federal in that way and anti-tribal. So then you add in the fact that they don't know anything about Indian law. They really don't. And I said this yesterday, most of them don't know much about the practice of law at the trial level itself. They were appellate litigators, national policymakers, appellate judges. They don't know anything about the practice of law at the trial level, and it is a totally different world. I also do not know anything really about the practice of law at the trial level. I know all about appellate litigation like law professors. We teach you appellate litigation. That's why you read appellate cases. We don't teach you, for the most part, unless you take a clinic or some of the legal writing stuff, you'll learn a little bit about trial level practice. But so I can't tell you that much about it. That's why the court screws things up. They miss out on that experience. And the clerks that they hire who should be there to help them, to guide them through this, are people that are just out of law school who themselves have never had really any trial experience either, or any experience at all for that matter. So if there is a wrinkle in a case that is related to trial experience, the court will always miss it, almost always. Even when somebody points it out to them in an amicus brief, they'll still miss it because they don't trust anybody who writes amicus briefs for the most part. So There are other structural and capacity reasons. They believe everything they're told, for example. So if somebody writes a dumb brief like Burlington Northern did on the Red Wolf case and, you know, during Strait, they believe it. They believe the worst that they can see. They're just like anybody who's on social media. They're drawn to the most outrageous statements. Whether or not they think they're right or wrong, they focus on them. And that tends to be, that shows up in their opinions. Even in like the big cases. I first noticed this in the big affirmative action cases involving the University of Michigan in the late 90s. You listen to oral argument, they do things like focus on briefs written by generals. Like the generals say, we lost Vietnam because we had a segregated, military. That's not why they lost Vietnam. It didn't help. But so they ask questions like, well, we heard that we might have to rule in favor of affirmative action because the generals and the admirals are saying we lost Vietnam because of a segregated military. You know, I mean, nobody knows that. I mean, that's ridiculous. But then they make that an issue in oral argument, and it shows up in the opinions. It's how ridiculous the court is. I mean, it's like I wrote a paper, which I should have assigned to you, that came out a couple of months ago in The Federal Lawyer, where he referred to the Supreme Court as reality television. That's all it is. You know, they're boring individual people, but collectively they love being in the news and being, that's why they do things like, we're only going to issue opinions, even when we're not in the building, at 10-minute intervals, just so you have 10 minutes to really grasp how awesome we are and what an amazing case. You know, they're probably watching how many hits they get in the New York Times for their opinions and stuff. They got to love that shit, at least some of them. And they love it when people write about how they're bitching at each other, too. They probably do get along individually. And so these opinions look like they hate each other's guts. But I think they're just fucking with us. Anyway, there's a lot more. I don't think we need new judges. You just have to know who the judges are and play to their biases and prejudices. And right now, the Supreme Court's great. I mean, we're like won 3 or 4 in a row because of Gorsuch. And, I don't know if that's going to continue. But, right now it's totally fine. Keep it. I don't know how you do that without violating somebody's First Amendment and due process rights to have their say. It's been a tradition at the court in the last 20 or 30 years. I don't know how you regulate something like that. And the Supreme Court won't do it. What they do is effectively just say, you know, implicitly, we don't read very many of them anyway, so it doesn't make an impact. But it's totally arbitrary as to which briefs they do read and which briefs they do believe. So they, you know, the court is open. The clerks will tell you they look for certain names. So if Neil Katyal or Carter Phillips writes an amicus brief, that some clerk's going to read that amicus brief. And they might be right. They're big time lawyers who charge $1,500, $2,000 an hour. So they're the only briefs that the only people who hire them are U.S. Chamber of Commerce, big corporations, big powerful entities, state governments sometimes, not always. So those are the interests that tend to be heard and taken seriously at the Supreme Court. An amicus brief written by a tribe who's trying to tell to inform the court, even, you know, not even in support of either party, if that a case like that came up, would not be considered serious by the court because it wouldn't be written by somebody who is that they know. And that's why they're kind of a running joke. They don't do anything seriously. And at least in my view, it's a running joke. It's reality television. The right way, I think, to regulate the court is to force the court to acknowledge that their whole process from top to bottom is just an overt violation of due process. The whole discretionary jurisdiction thing, giving them the ability to choose which cases they hear, cannot possibly be fair. Absolutely is not. You know, I that But you, the only way that you can get them to acknowledge it is for them themselves to say we're being unfair, and they will never, obviously, never do that. Now, maybe if you get a whole bunch of new judges in there who are self-hating Supreme Court justices, they might change some of their processes. But a court that can decide which cases it hears and is overtly strategic about which cases it hears, to create a fact pattern that is in line with what the majority wants the law to be, is by definition a violation of due process. It can't possibly be fair, but that's what they do in almost every single case. You know, like the McGirt case. Why did they choose McGirt? There's two or three other cases that are pending in the Supreme Court from other parties. Why did they choose Murphy? I think they were stuck with Murphy in part because he's on death row. And they tend to take death penalty cases more seriously than other cases. A few years back, there were some sovereign immunity cases that had the exact same fact patterns, the exact same legal issues, but different fact patterns. The court took the worst conceivable one from the point of view of tribal interests, in order to make it the worst way for tribes to win. Ironically, if I recall correctly, it was Lewis versus Clark. There were multiple tribal employee immunity cases pending at the Supreme Court, and they took the worst fact pattern, which was an off-reservation fact pattern involving a casino. Everybody hates casinos. With a limousine driver, on a highway, who got into a car wreck. And there were other fact patterns that, you know, involved tribal police officers, for example. They denied cert in cases like that because they don't want to put police officers, make them liable for a crime or for a tort. So they chose a limousine driver over that. But it was the exact same legal question. So they do stuff like that on purpose. And I find that wildly offensive. All this stuff with amicus, you know, they could just stop doing it. But they won't. I mean, that would be weird. And I don't know how to regulate something like that. Lower courts, you know, you have to ask for leave to file an amicus brief. And I think that's probably a violation of due process, too, because then the court can just pick and choose its friends and who it wants to hear from. I think that's the way it used to be before amicus briefs became so endemic in Supreme Court and appellate court litigation. Everybody writes an amicus brief now. When people like me are writing amicus briefs at the Supreme Court, you know that, you know, that it's complete shit show. All right. Next question. Amanda, how did you end up with a bunch of numbers in the middle of your name? You were Amanda Smith yesterday. That's all right. Just curious. It doesn't. I was actually admiring your Pink Floyd t-shirt. All right. Any other questions on Indian law? Anything? Okay. Yeah, so, you know, each admission act, for mostly the states west of the Mississippi, there was some deliberation about whether to allow the state to have jurisdiction over Indian country. And I think this probably arose when they started thinking about granting statehood to Oklahoma as far back as like 1834, and you might know Oklahoma did not get statehood for a good 70 years after that. So in some instances, some states in the West, it was a big deal. The state said, well, we've got these huge reservations here. What does that mean for our control over the state? So I guess just that the bigger answer is, they actually is in Nevada versus Hicks. This Justice Scalia wrote that ordinarily Indian reservations within a state are considered the part of the territory of the state. The state doesn't really have plenary jurisdiction over those reservations in any meaningful way, unless Congress grants them that jurisdiction. Even in Public Law 280 states, the state doesn't have plenary jurisdiction. They don't really have, they have criminal jurisdiction, but they don't really have the right to tax anything on the reservation. That's tribal. They can't tax Indian lands. They can't tax individual Indian income or business activities. And they don't really have really any kind of serious regulatory authority at all over Indian country, even in Public Law 280 states. So they often assert it anyway, but they generally don't. So I'm not really sure what the scope of your question. It really just go ahead. Maybe you can. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the litigation over off-reservation hunting and fishing rights, which might be related to a treaty or a federal statute, is really a supremacy clause argument as opposed to a property rights argument. There are those who characterize the off-reservation hunting and fishing rights as property rights, and they are very, very similar. There's a lot of parallels there. But effectively, what the argument is that the state is trying to exercise its power, police powers, over that activity, and federal law prohibits it through the Supremacy Clause, either because a treaty guarantees Indians the right to hunt and fish off the reservation or because a federal statute authorizes that activity. And it's really a Supremacy Clause question. But the way it is described and kind of enforced is as if it were some sort of easement or a prescription on top of lands that are owned by the state, governed by the state, or owned by non-Indians. In theory, this very rarely happens, but in theory, Indians could have the right to go onto somebody's private property and exercise their hunting and fishing rights. We had that as an open question here in Michigan for many years. So the 1836 treaty is a treaty that currently five federally recognized tribes are signatories and beneficiaries of. And about one third of the state, the lower peninsula of Michigan, and half of the upper peninsula is the subject of the 1836 treaty. That was the area of the land cession. So that's ceded territory. And until 2004 or 5 or 6 or 7, my guess 7, it was an open question whether Indians could go on public and private property within the ceded territory to exercise hunting and fishing rights, because they just hadn't been litigated. When we did litigate them in U.S. v. Michigan in the 70s, it was about the lakes, Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, Lake Superior. The inland stuff we didn't touch for the longest time. And once in a while, a tribal member would go in somebody's back 40 and, you know, poach a deer and get popped for it and then say, treaty rights. And then we always think that would be the moment that would generate the big case. But it never really went anywhere until 2004. And then we just negotiated everything out. It was never really litigated. So But in theory, that could happen. It's not, the optics are terrible. When somebody buys land within a ceded territory and, you know, lives on it, has a residence or a farm or something, you know, it's bad news when a tribal member runs around trying to exercise treaty rights. And, you know, you and I both know people who are like that, who would totally do that because they're just, they want to fuck shit up. That's all there is to it. But generally speaking, it's not considered a property interest. That said, I've characterized it in this class as a property interest. If it is taken away, I think at that point, the proper view of it is as a property interest that is guaranteed by a vested property interest that is guaranteed by the treaty itself. I know those seem like contradictory things, but they're not. By the way, I'm not a property professor, so there's that. I do know a little bit about takings of private property, and we know that through the Teton case, which is a terrible case in 1955, where the Supreme Court said that in Alaska, the taking of Indian Aboriginal title or original Indian title, whatever you want to call it, is not compensable. There's no mandate for compensation under the Just Compensation and Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. There's that. But the Teton case does give us the test for when Congress or the United States creates a property interest. And it does so through an act of Congress, a treaty, executive order, perhaps, even a federal regulation. All of those things can be the source of a vested property interest. And if there's some sort of monetary value that you can associate with that property interest, and it is taken by an act of Congress or somebody else, then it's totally compensable. So if a tribe has the right to, you know, regulate speeding on the reservation because of some sort of act of Congress, there's no real monetary value to the tribe to that. Yeah, they can pull people over and issue tickets or whatever, and money comes from that, but that's not really a property interest. But if the individual Indians through the tribe have a right to go subsistence hunting and fishing on or off reservation, and that's taken away, there absolutely is a monetary compensation, monetary component of value to that right, as opposed to a quote sovereign right, which is not really compensable. I mean, maybe it should be, but and these things have not been litigated truly fully, but that would be my sense, if you can attach a monetary component. Yeah, but if nobody speeds on the reservation, there's no money. Or even if nobody pays the ticket because they just refuse to comply with the tribal order, there's no money. So there's no vested guarantee interest in compensation. Whereas if somebody has the right, I mean, you have to eat. You absolutely have to eat. So even if you don't sell the deer or the fish, you're still eating them, and that's a monetary value that if you lose that is compensable. It's part of the economy, I guess you could say. Whereas sovereign rights are not part of the economy. I'm just thinking off the top of my head, it's actually kind of like the Commerce Clause, right? You know, you guys read Wickard versus Filburn? All the conservatives hate that case. And it's about a guy during the Great Depression who he wanted to grow some shit, but he didn't want to sell it on the market. But by virtue of growing it and then not selling it, he was still part of interstate commerce by refusing to add his wheat or whatever it was he was growing to the national market on wheat. And he was affecting that market, even though it was just a de minimis impact. It was still a monetary value associated with his failure or refusal to enter the market. And so, conversely, if a state government wanted to regulate that and Congress took that away, the state is not compensated whenever they lose the right to do something because of an act of Congress. There's no compensation available. Maybe they can get it blocked because it violates the 10th Amendment or some other thing, but they don't get compensation for losing the right to regulate something. See, now you know what it looks like when I'm talking out my ass. Any other questions? Yeah, so we know from Lone Wolf versus Hitchcock that there's the Fifth Amendment takings clause is not fairly applied to Indian property rights. So let's say Congress took a reservation and chopped it up and distributed some of the lands individually to tribal citizens and then sold off the rest of the lands to non-Indians. The sale of the land and the assets that are received by the Department of Interior from the sale of surplus lands goes back to the tribe. Now, Interior took back in those days an administrative fee that was upwards of 80% of the sale. And the sale itself was usually pennies on the dollar of the true value of that land, even the shitty surplus land. So the actual compensation of the tribe for the loss of their surplus lands was a minute percentage of its actual value. The Supreme Court said, because it's Indian affairs, we give deference to the United States as to what is just compensation, and that we will say that's good enough. And the same is true for the taking of reservation land and conversion of allotment lands, and then the distribution of that land to individual Indians. Is also, if there is a taking of the reservation, that the allotment itself is part of that compensation. So what the court said, it was a transformation of a trust asset from one thing into another, which is garbage. And the Supreme Court said it was okay when it came to allotment. It was never really tested in the termination era. But I think that era ended in 1980 with the United States versus Sioux Tribe of Indians case, the Sioux Nation case, the Black Hills case. The United States from 1903, if not before, until 1980, basically acted as if it decided unilaterally what just compensation was for the taking of a Indian or a tribal property interest. And at the Supreme Court, Justice Blackmun got the Department of Justice to admit that the taking of the Black Hills, the United States compensation for the taking of the Black Hills was rancid meat. Basically, the treaty established the reservation to include the Black Hills. The United States unilaterally took the Black Hills through acts of Congress. They forced Indian people, the tribal leaders, to sign on to those agreements. By saying, we'll kill you, or you sign the agreements. And when you sign the agreements, you'll at least get rations for 5 years from the United States. And of course, the rations the United States Army gave to the Sioux Indians was rancid meat and maggoty bread and terrible, terrible things. Useless food, nothing, in effect. And at oral argument, Justice admitted that their position was rancid meat was just compensation for the taking of the Black Hills. And that argument was valid under the Lone Wolf analysis. And the Supreme Court rejected it because the fact pattern was just so awful. Justice still makes those arguments to this day, that they deserve that kind of deference when they make Indian affairs decisions. I wrote a paper, a very small portion of a paper that a guy named Daniel Raybear wrote. We published it in a Michigan secondary journal in the last couple of years. And in the last 10 years, Department of Justice attorneys have been sanctioned repeatedly by federal court judges all over the country for making arguments like they made in the Sioux Nation case and in Lone Wolf. They still make those arguments at Justice that you have to defer to, that every time the Interior Department makes a decision adverse to Indian interests, that a federal court must defer to that regardless of whether it makes any sense whatsoever. And that is not the law, but they make that argument all the time. They make it at the Supreme Court frequently too, The Supreme Court doesn't sanction people, but lower court judges do. And so they get dinged on this all the time. They still make shitty arguments like that. So does that answer your question? I kind of went off on a little bit of a tangent there at the end, but... Any other questions? Oh, Lauren, I see you have the Darth Vader and Stormtroopers on your shirt. Very nice. I got Pacific Northwest. I think it's a bear today. Anybody else? I think they can work together. The VAWA, you're talking about the tribal jurisdictional provisions of VAWA. So what the Major Crimes Act, even if there was a conflict in the text, there's a canon of statutory construction that the more specific statute controls over the more general statute. And VAWA is definitely more specific. It's limited to only two classes of crimes. And it's so I suspect that VAWA does not would not preempt a tribe, or excuse me, that the Major Crimes Act would not preempt a tribe from exercising felony jurisdiction under VAWA and sentencing somebody up to up to 9 years in jail for different kinds of offenses potentially. So, but because it's so specific, and but I don't think it. This is the weird thing about the Major Crimes Act that I think is a really interesting problem of constitutional jurisprudence, in that, you know, the statute reads, the federal government shall have exclusive jurisdiction over these crimes specifically. But because, as I said in earlier parts of the class, you can, a federal and or tribal prosecutor can massage which statute to use based on how they charge a case. So that's why you have double jeopardy type cases that go to the Supreme Court, like U.S. v. Lara and U.S. v. Wheeler, because the tribe may prosecute a case as a misdemeanor, even though it is effectively a felony, like rape or assaulting a federal officer or a tribal officer. Those are felonies, but if you charge them as misdemeanors, as essentially lesser included offenses, that would invoke the double jeopardy clause, but it does not implicate the Major Crimes Act exclusivity provision. I don't think VAWA definitely is not preempted by the Major Crimes Act. Plus, it comes after. If anything, if there was a direct conflict, VAWA would be considered as an implied repeal of whatever portion of the Major Crimes Act it's conflicting with. So that should be fine. I don't think it does conflict, though. It's a great question. It is. Yeah, the jurisdictional maze of Indian country criminal jurisdiction. You know, Bob Clinton came up, I don't know if he invented that, but he became famous for writing that. And it's so true. That metaphor of Indian country criminal jurisdiction as a maze is very powerful and not inaccurate. So, any other questions? You know, I wanted to highlight something today just for this class. I posted a case on Turtle Talk today, this morning, just a few minutes before class, involving the Snoqualmie Casino. And it's a nothing case in some ways. You know, a year ago, even a few months ago, I would have posted it and not even thought anything about it. But the fact pattern of the case is a woman who lives off the reservation. She's African American. She paid $10 to get on a bus that would take her from wherever she was to the Snoqualmie Reservation. Tribes have buses like this all the time to get people to come out to their properties. She got there. She stayed well into the early morning, and she was out of money. So she could, there was no bus that went back, or she couldn't afford to take a bus. She had no way to get a taxi. And it was in the middle of the night, and she was basically being told by the casino she had to leave. And she couldn't. She literally could not find a way. She asked for somebody to give her a ride. I don't know. She may have been, I don't know if this is in, and because they're in a casino, she may have been inebriated in some way. I don't know. If you read her complaint, it reads very much like somebody who is being abused by the tribal security, tribal police, whoever was, you know, inside. They weren't physically, I mean, she did allege physical harm, so there's that. But they made her leave the casino and, you know, injured her in some way. But it's basically just a boring old case of, you know, then she wrote she's not represented by an attorney. She couldn't get an attorney, perhaps. She wrote a handwritten complaint in federal court alleging various civil rights violations and injuries against the Snoqualmie Casino. The case is called Cadet versus Snoqualmie Casino. The tribe, you know, has outside counsel, big law firm, Kilpatrick Townsend. They wrote a really simple motion to dismiss. But all of this is implicates everything we said about in this class. So, the tribe's motion to dismiss is we're immune from suit. The tribe did enact a Tribal Tort Claims Act. It did waive its immunity for claims just like this. Well, mostly slip and fall claims. I don't know about claims against tribal police, but it did waive its immunity in tribal court. And one thing we have not talked about in much detail is how tribes waive their immunity to try to direct litigation against the tribes to a venue that they want to be, that they want to defend in. And usually that's tribal court. Not always, but usually it is tribal court. So we have not talked about Tribal Tort Claims Acts, which I think are really important, with suits against tribes. We've mostly, in the last couple of days in particular, talked about suits against non-members. But tribes want non-members to bring claims against them in tribal court. So you have a Tribal Tort Claims Act that waives immunity in tribal court. It also creates a process that a non-member must follow if it is going to effectuate a claim against the tribe. Most states have, even ones that have gone through tort reform and have restricted who can bring a claim under state law, your statute of limitations is at least a year, sometimes as many as 6 or 8 years. You don't often know if you're injured for a long time after you've been injured, if it's something that takes a long time to discover. And under state law, if you're suing a private party, that private party isn't immune from suit. And so equitably, sometimes a statute of limitation can be told, meaning you could, not T-O-L-D, but T-O-L-L-E-D. And so you can even get past the statute of limitations problem if you have a really good equitable reason to do so. But when you're suing a government, that is immune from suit, equitable tolling of a statute of limitations is not available to you. And what some tribes do, and I think they're moving away from this, but in the early years of enacting these Tort Claims Acts, some tribes would say that the statute of limitations is 45 days. So if you were this woman who was injured at a tribal casino on January 1, and the tribe has a Tort Claims Act that says you have to write a certified letter that is to be delivered, has to be served in a formal way on a very specific tribal employee. Maybe it's the tribal CEO. Maybe it's the tribal attorney's office or the tribal chair within 45 days. And if you don't do that, the tribe's wall of sovereign immunity covers up any opportunity you have for judicial review or for your claim. And tribes used to write things, you know, their attorneys on behalf of their tribal client used to write things in a very obtuse way to make it so that it would be really hard for them to have a claim. As a tribal judge, at an appellate level, I've had a good half dozen cases where, the Tribes Tort Claims Act is such a difficult thing for even a lawyer to follow that nobody could really comply with it. They only have a few weeks or months to file the claim, and they have to find the right person to do that. First, you have to find the Tribal Tort Claims Act in the first place. It better be online somewhere. Some tribes are not putting their laws online because sovereignty. And but then, you know, people would, the personal injury lawyers who are used to equitable tolling would just say, well, I couldn't find it, or there's a good reason why we couldn't file the claim until after 6 months after the injury. Under the doctrines of sovereign immunity, you know, waivers of immunity are to be construed narrowly, and they're jurisdictional, so they can't be equitably tolled. And so this case, I thought, was, you know, interesting. It's routine. It's likely that the woman cadet has no remedy, even if she was seriously injured in some way. She probably wasted all of her time in federal court and didn't file the claim in conformance with the Tribal Tort Claims Act and has no remedy. But plus, she's not a lawyer, isn't represented by counsel. And I, you know, in some ways, it's a police brutality case by tribal police. I imagine tribal police are not tribal members, not always. So it's, you know, white cop on black person abusing them, no remedy whatsoever, which is not actually any different than most places, you know, because of qualified immunity and that sort of thing. But there's just a lot going on here. And you guys have asked about who's liable under a 638 contract. That is at issue here too, right? If she had a lawyer, the next step is to find out if the tribal police officer security guard was acting in accordance with a 638 contract. And it's an outside chance and unlikely, but maybe the federal government is the next stage, the next possible defendant in the claim under the Federal Tort Claims Act. Probably not, because 638 law enforcement contracts usually do not cover casino operations. They're excluded from that, but not always. Maybe they're in the parking lot, not in the casino, and they're on tribal trust land. And once the tribal police officer leaves the casino, they're back under the governance of the 638 contract. I mean, you can see how that, all of these things that we talked about today are encapsulated in this one little case. And that is a nothing case. It won't be reported and it won't be appealed. But pretty much everything we talked about outside of Indian child welfare is in this case in some way. Any other questions? It does sometimes, but not always. There are times when, you know, I get this question a lot, especially in the restatement project. Why would a tribe that has sovereign immunity ever hire or purchase insurance, workers' compensation insurance, or just general liability insurance? Some tribes refuse, pay insurance premiums, but don't waive their immunity anywhere. And you might wonder why they would ever do that. And there's a couple of reasons. For business purposes, tribes want to have a good reputation for business goodwill. And so if there is tribal liability, they want their insurance company to defend them and pay out, damage awards, negotiate damage awards, not litigate damage awards. Most tribes do that are serious, that take all that have, you know, are accountable to creditors, for example, when they borrow money to open up a casino, do have fairly liberal tort claims acts. And the reason for that is you just never know when you're going to get a judge, especially a tribal judge, who just throws up their hands and says, nope, this tribe doesn't have sovereign immunity anymore because I'm sick of these stupid cases and the tribe's being an asshole, right? There's a judge here in Michigan who's older now, But when the tribes are getting going in Michigan in the 80s and 90s, he was always doing the right thing and dismissing cases on sovereign immunity grounds. But it was, he was writing opinions in which he was expressing his regret and dissatisfaction with what the tribe was doing. The tribe's insurance companies were reading those opinions and saying, this guy's going to, the dam's going to burst one day. He's going to lose it. And we're going to end up with a $30 million judgment or something like that. So tribal insurance premiums started going through the roof. They were paying two or three times what other entities and with a similar kind of operation and potential liability were paying. So the tribes and the insurance companies negotiated tort claims acts that would relieve some of that pressure and make the judge happy, make judges like that judge happy. But there are still instances. Workers' comp is a good one, where a tribe really is willing to pay workers' comp, but they don't want to waive their immunity. So tribes often fight with insurance companies themselves. The attorneys are like, hey, you got sovereign immunity. I'm just going to file a motion to dismiss, and we'll never pay anything out. So the tribes actually have to argue with their own side, their insurance companies, to make sure that the companies know, as a matter of business goodwill, the tribe has bought insurance defense, but not authorize the insurance company to raise sovereign immunity. And insurance companies sometimes need to be educated on that point. And it's not an easy thing for insurance companies to understand. So that's why there's so few insurance companies that actually work with tribes, because it's so frustrating with them. Workers' comp is tricky, especially in states where the tribes have signed on to state workers' compensation programs rather than start their own. And so that you'll see the occasional sovereign immunity case where a tribe doesn't want to pay out workers' comp to somebody or unemployment insurance or something like that because they just didn't like that employee for whatever reason. And so they raise their immunity at a later stage. But as a general matter, you can imagine courts really hate that. The tribe shows up and litigates a case for a couple of years, and you know, and then at the end it just throws up its hands and says, "Now we're immune from suit. Fuck it." Everybody, and it all goes away. But the judges hate that. And sometimes they sanction the attorneys for not, I don't know, out of spite, I guess. I don't know. I don't know if that really answers your question, but it wanted to give you a little bit more of a universe. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Everything is, it's weird. You know, we have, we started doing a conference here several years ago now with the Tribal In-House Counsel Association to try to compete with the big Indian Law Conference that the Federal Bar Association does. And that's, the FBA one is just, you know, big national use, you know, Supreme Court cases and big appellate cases. And in-house counsel is not finding those kinds of conferences useful. The nuts and bolts, day-to-day operation and legal work that they do. And when we started the conference, the first thing that the tribal in-house counsel people who were advising us said, we want to have panels every year on insurance, which is boring as shit, but man, they're not. When they get going, we had a panel one year where it was an Indian woman who works for a big firm that does insurance defense, an Indian woman who works in-house, and then another Indian person who did something. I don't know. It doesn't matter if they're men or women. But the fact that they were all Indians working at various stages, they started arguing with each other about the problem of the complicated question of when you call your insurance company. So the insurance company says, every time there's an accident, you call us right away. And if you don't, you're not covered. And the tribal attorney says, we're not going to call you for everything. Some things we can handle ourselves. And hopefully it doesn't get too big. And then we'll call you later. But if we called you for every little thing that happened, then our premiums would go up every single time we call you. And the insurance defense, you know, outside counsel said, well, that's not true, but it totally is. Every time you call your insurance company, that goes into the formula for determining your premiums the next year or the next cycle or whatever. So the in-house counsel There's no answer to it, but at least they were seeing and hearing sort of what, you know, that the insurance defense people would say, right? And they were not to be trusted. That's all there is to it. They're all on the same side, right? But they're not. So the tribe can always threaten the insurance company with bad faith in refusing to defend. And the insurance company can always say the tribe didn't engage in bad faith but failed to notify in accordance with the insurance policy. So there, you know, there's always room for error. I had a tribal appellate case out of Porch Band Creek, which was the tribe waited and waited and last minute sent something, referred something over to the insurance company. The insurance company refused to accept it. And so the tribe sued them in tribal court. The insurance company, this is a non-member jurisdiction case, but the insurance company effectively won on the merits. One of my co-judges at Porch Band used to work insurance, so he knew that law better than I did. But he was also sort of predisposed to the insurance company's point of view, whereas I was predisposed not. In any event, we agreed that the tribe waited too long. So, all right, I don't have anything else to say, but I don't want to cut off any questions. And we really haven't had a break, but unless there's any other questions, and please feel free to ask them as long as you want. I'm here until the next hour and a half, but, you know, I'm done. We can be done anytime you want. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, you know, nobody writes books on jurisdiction. Frank Pommersheim writes some nice books. He's really the man. My favorite books on tribal jurisdiction are the ones that Louise Erdrich writes, like The Roundhouse. Really fascinating. I mean, it's hard. It's literary fiction, but the whole factual predicate, it is about tribal jurisdiction on a checkerboarded reservation. She wrote a really nice book that just came out called The Night Watchman, which is about the termination era. Really good stuff. I mean, just really puts sort of the personal imprint, the emotional imprint on these big federal Indian law and policy questions. But if you want to really nerd out on tribal jurisdiction, Frank Pommersheim is probably the man. Yeah, the Louise Erdrich books are emotionally fraught, to say the least. They're tough, especially The Roundhouse, which is the subject matter is about sexual assault. It's also about the Indian Child Welfare Act. So, any other questions? I did a book club for a book that I wrote about 20 years ago, about a bunch of mini short stories that I wrote about being, living in Indian country that were terribly written. I'm a shitty fiction writer, so they're stupid as hell, but it was fun because it was my mom's book club. I can always get my mom to read my stuff if nobody else. Any other questions? Well, all right, so I'm done. I want to thank you all. You've been a wonderful class, and the questions are great. These are really complicated issues, as you know. I'm certainly free to, you can always reach out anytime. Just say, hey, just remind me who you are, where I know you. Anytime the rest of your career, reach out. Just say, hey, I took this class with you in summer of 2020, and, you know, I'm in tribal jail, and I want to know how to get out. So reach out to me. I'll refer you to my brother, who will then refer you to someone who knows something about something. So, in any event, I hope you enjoyed it. And, I think we should all have a drink. have a good afternoon and good week. I look forward to reading your papers in a few weeks too. So take it easy. Absolutely. Do 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 do.